Some months ago, some of us, one or two of us, examined the dialogue of one of the prophets of the Old Testament that he had with God. It's a prophet that we know very little about, but his discussion, as we saw, has a lot to tell us about faith, what it is, and how we can become like one of the faithful we read about in the Scriptures. And to kind of recap what we talked about in that first message, we talked briefly of Abraham, a man we identify as a person of great faith, but who at times, as Scriptures show, wavered in his constancy, much as any of us might when our prayers seem to go unanswered. And Habakkuk, the man we're going to talk about, was a man like Abraham, a prophet of God who saw the evil of the nation around him and asked God to do something about it. God gave him a message in response, a message that Habakkuk called a burden. And indeed it was a burden of sorts, knowing the evil around him and knowing what God was going to do about it, which was not a pleasant thing. We saw in chapter 1, the first part of the dialogue that Habakkuk had with God. In that dialogue, Habakkuk asked God why he wasn't doing anything about the evil in the nation around him. He wondered why God was taking so long to bring justice. He was in despair, just as we come to despair when we think that God isn't answering our prayers. And then when God finally did answer, Habakkuk did not receive the answer he expected, just as we often get answers to our prayers that do not conform to our expectations. Habakkuk thought that God would answer his prayer by punishing the evil people of Judah and purifying the nation. God said that indeed he would do that, but the vision of the future that he gave to Habakkuk involved a punishment in a form that Habakkuk did not expect. God promised he would take care of things, but he would do so by bringing a people, an empire, that was evil in and of itself against the whole of the nation of Judah. Judah was to fall to the Babylonians. And this unexpected answer caused Habakkuk to fall into a way of thinking that we humans often too easily drop into, something we might term self-righteousness. Judah, Habakkuk's nation, was bad, he thought, but it wasn't as bad as those Chaldeans. Judah had the law, and we too can believe ourselves better than those around us because we have knowledge that others lack, even if we don't live according to that knowledge. But God has a different standard. Our actions are judged by what we know, by the knowledge that we do have. And so if we know more, more is expected of us. Another's evil, thus, does not excuse our own, even if, in the scheme of things, what we do seems less bad than that which others do. And it was precisely the same with ancient Judah. Habakkuk returned to God with another question, asking how it is that God could, in fact, turn around and bring even more evil to take care of evil. And that is where we left off, right there at chapter 2, at the beginning of chapter 2. So that's where we're going to go, to Habakkuk 2 and verse 1. Here Habakkuk denotes that he knows that on some level his query with regard to God's proposed punishment of Judah is impertinent. For as Habakkuk states in the first chapter, he knows God is supremely wise. And here in Habakkuk 2 and verse 1, he states that he is willing to accept God's answer, but also that he doesn't understand. And then he humbly asks for understanding, even as we, when we receive answers to prayers that don't seem to make sense, should ask for understanding. Habakkuk 2 and verse 1 reads, "I will stand upon my watch," he says, Habakkuk 2 verse 1, "I will stand upon my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected." So Habakkuk expects correction for his complaint, but he also states that he will wait to see what God will say to his query. Having the patience to wait, then, when we don't understand why God is answering our prayer as he is answering it, it's very important. And it is, in the end, the heart of what faith is about, believing God will answer our prayers and trusting God's answer when it comes. Today we're going to look at that answer, the answer that God gave to Habakkuk, as it is stated in chapter 2 of this short book. God's answer, as we will see, is one that gives Habakkuk reassurance. It comes in two parts. In the first part, God tells Habakkuk that he needs to wait even longer. And in the second, God provides Habakkuk with a list of woes, things any nation should be wary of doing, things any person should be wary of doing. So we have waiting and then a list of things we should be wary of. Let's start with Habakkuk 2, verses 2 through 5. We read here, "And the Lord answered me and said, Write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, and it will not tarry." So God hands Habakkuk a vision. He tells Habakkuk that it is yet for a time in the future and that will come. It will come to pass in the land, but one has to wait for it. Let's go to Luke 18. Luke 18, verses 1 through 8. We looked at this scripture last time as well. There, we read a parable about the widow and the judge. A parable that has much to tell us about prayer and about faith. Luke 18, verses 1 through 8. Here, Jesus Christ says, and he spoke a parable to them that men ought always to pray and not lose heart, saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, Get justice for me from my adversary. And he would not for a while. But afterward he said within himself, Though I do not fear God nor regard him, yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. Then the Lord said, Hear what the unjust judge said. Now shall God not avenge his own elect, who cry out day and night to him, though he bears long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he really find faith on the earth?" The main point of this parable, as denoted here at the start, is that we should continue to pray, even when we think God isn't answering. We're told that God indeed does hear, that if an earthly unjust judge answers the requests of a woman he does not care about because he gets tired of her asking, how much more likely is God to answer us, a God who cares about us and loves us? Indeed, we're told he will answer, and he'll do so speedily. But this speed is something that we often don't understand. It seems slow to us. In Psalm 103 and verse 8, God says that he is slow to anger. But when he does act, he acts with haste. World events are often the same way, building for a long while in a manner that we don't take notice of, and then taking place in a very short period. I'm reminded of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Most of us probably remember that. The Cold War with Russia was, for those of us born between 1950 and 1980, a fact of life, something that we had to deal with for the whole of our existence. And no matter what we heard, if we grew up in the church, heard Mr. Armstrong in the church preaching about the subject, it was still at times difficult to conceive of a world that was not split between a communist society and a capitalist one, between two great superpowers, and a world where that struggle, it seemed to everybody, was going to end up in some kind of great nuclear conflict between the two powers. And yet we were told over and over again that, you know, Russia and the United States were not going to come to blows. And then in 1989, seemingly overnight, a wall that symbolized the break between these two sides of the planet and an entire worldview came to an end. And now there were certainly actions leading up to it. You know, we had perestroika and glasnost and all these other things. But, you know, it was really hard to believe that that was going to lead that way, that it was just going to lead to the dissolution of the USSR. And yet, that's what happened. And it happened very quickly once it got going. Let's go on and continue in Habakkuk 2, verses 4 through 5. God here warns Habakkuk about the thoughts of the Jews, as evidenced in Habakkuk's statements in the previous chapter, and about the thoughts of the Chaldeans. "Behold the proud, His soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Indeed, because he transgresses wine, he is a proud man. He does not stay at home, because he enlarges his desire as hell. And he is like death and cannot be satisfied. He gathers to himself all nations and heaps up for himself all people. So here we have a comparison between the faithful and those whose soul is lifted up. The implication is that those who are lifted up, those who have pride, those who look to themselves or think themselves good, will lack faith and will, by extension, lack the ability to be just, seeing themselves as worthy of more than they have and more than others have. They give in to desire and gather from others as they will, not taking into account the needs of others. When we're self-righteous, when we think that we build our own righteousness of our own doing, then we fail to see God's role in that righteousness and fail to see how belief, how faith, is related to all that we in fact have. Likewise, we will fail to see the justice of God's actions or the answers to his prayers. And this was as much a problem for Judah, which thought itself righteous because it had the true God, though it failed to obey him, as it was for Babylon, which ascribed its power to itself and to its false God. What then follows in Habakkuk is a list of woes. We come to the second part here. Things God says a nation should be wary of, and the corresponding punishment that shall come upon such a nation. That is, in a sense, God's answer to Habakkuk's concern about the Chaldeans being used as a means to exact punishment on Judah. God, in essence, says that the Chaldeans, indeed any nation that acts in such a manner, will see its actions returned upon itself. Before we get into this list of woes, let's go back to Genesis 9 and verse 6. We're going to see a concept back here that your own unjust actions will be thrown back on you, that this concept is biblical. It's both in the Old and New Testaments. Genesis 9 and verse 6, after the Noahic flood, God established, and we can say re-emphasized, this basic principle with Noah and his descendants. Genesis 9 and verse 6 says, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." So connected to this concept here of a killer, of men being killed by other men, we see, is a concept that man is created in God's image. When a person kills another person, he or she kills someone created in the image of God. And God will, in a sense, have his vengeance, he says here, through yet another person made in God's image. This is the cost that the sins of the fathers are visited on the children of the third and fourth generation. Now let's look to a New Testament example. Let's go to Matthew 26 and verse 52. These are Christ's words here. Matthew 26 and verse 52. Here Peter sets out to defend Christ with a sword by cutting off the ear of one of the high priest's servants. And after healing the servant, Christ alludes back to this Noahic warning. Isaiah 26 and verse 52, he says to Peter, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword." So it is within this principle that God places the woes to the Chaldeans. They rely on the sword. They boast in themselves. They do not live by faith. They do not deal justly with other people. What are the results of this way of life? God reveals that now in Habakkuk 2, verses 6 through 20. So even as God is going to punish Judah, basically he's saying, don't worry, the Chaldeans themselves will also face a punishment. So he lists five woes in verses 6 through 20. Let's look at the first woe. It's verses 6 through 8. "Will not all these take up a proverb against him and a taunting riddle against him and say, 'Woe to him who increases what is not his. How long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges. Will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you? And you will become their booty? Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you, because of men's blood and the violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it." So our first woe, then, is to those who increased that which is not theirs. Okay? Those who increased that which is not theirs. The general principle of those who live by the sword die by it is restated here. The reward for this woe is for the perpetrators to be spoiled as they have spoiled other nations. Let's go down to verses 9 through 11. Verses 9 through 11 establish for us the second woe. Woe to him who covets evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of disaster. You give shameful counsel to your house, cutting off many peoples, and sin against your soul. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the timbers will answer it. So the second woe, then, is to those that covet to set themselves on high, to set themselves above the results of the evil that they perpetrate. There's been much attention in the media about the widening gap between the rich and the poor in the United States. And my purpose here isn't to get into a discussion about class here, but I do want to note that there is a set of people in this nation whose riches sometimes allow them to perpetrate evil without a great amount of fear with regard to the consequences. And refer to one case in point. There was a Texas teenager who got caught in an accident while driving intoxicated at nearly three times the legal limit. And this accident killed four people. And in court, the lawyer, hired by his very wealthy parents, argued that the teen suffered from wealth. He suffered from a sense of entitlement to getting what he wants, to never having to suffer the consequences of his action. What he needed, the defense argued, was therapy, not jail time. He was too rich to go to jail. The well-off can sometimes escape the consequences of the tragedies that they engender to others. Let's turn to James 5. James 5. God here, in the second woe in Habakkuk, is saying that there is not an escape, ultimately, for those who place themselves above others because of what they take from them in terms of riches. The evil perpetrated by the rich, who think they stand above the law because of their riches, is something that God takes very seriously throughout the Scripture. And James makes many references to the problems that can accrue with the disparity between wealth. And in this second chapter, he points out how some in the church give partiality to the rich. And in the fourth chapter, he concerns himself specifically with the sin of covetousness. Let's look at then James 5, actually. We're going to go one chapter forward, James 5, verses 1 through 6. And here, James makes special note of the ultimate consequences those who are covetous reap. James 5, verses 1 through 6. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived on earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. Here God promises misery in exchange for the misery that those who are better off have brought on those who are not so well off. Because those riches came at the expense of the poor, God will provide retribution. In part, this woe is brought upon by the fact that such people put their faith not in God, but in the things that they are able to gather for themselves, no matter the cost. It's like the parable of the rich fool. Let's go to our next scripture, Luke 12. Parable of the rich fool. Luke 12, verses 15 through 21. Christ told this parable in response to a man who had asked him to rule on a matter of inheritance. One man was being shut out of receiving this inheritance because his brother was taking it all. This man wanted Christ to take action. But Christ denoted that the man's focus was wrong. Christ wasn't here to deal with physical possessions. And the man himself, Christ noted, was too focused on these physical possessions. The parable he told in response followed in Luke 12, verses 15 through 21. And he said, or Christ said to them, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses." And then he spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'Who shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' So he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. And then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" So here, this man receives blessings beyond what he is able to use at one time, and his focus after receiving this blessing is entirely on himself, to make his own way of life easy, to drink, to eat, to be merry, to party. But what does God ask of us? He asks that we seek his kingdom first. All these other things, he says, will be added to us. And in seeking that kingdom, one of the things he asks is that we take care of those who are less fortunate. He asks us to look out for the poor and the needy, not to take from others even what little they have in order to spend it on ourselves, in order to take care of ourselves. Using riches to stand above the evil one perpetrates on others to gain those riches is like building a house on stilts. And when the flood comes, the stilts will keep you above the trouble, but the stilts are very thin support to put one's faith in. If one stilt fails, so too does the entire house. So rather, our faith should be built on the one who has control over those floods, the one who supplies the wood for the building, the one who does all of those things in the first place. We are to put our faith in a rock, in a fortress, and that is what God compares himself to. His protection is assured. Let's go now to the third woe, Habakkuk 2, verses 12 through 14. Habakkuk 2, verses 12 through 14, we come to the third woe. "Woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor to feed the fire, and nations weary themselves in vain? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Here, national and governmental aspirations of humans are compared with a government that will eventually replace all human government. And what do we read in Revelation 18 and verse 24 but this very thing? Revelation 18 and verse 24 talks about a world system, a city within which, quote, "was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." And then in Revelation 19, Christ comes with his kingdom and does away with this city, this world system that is established through violence. As with the woe that came before, this woe is on the vanity of prioritizing the world. The second woe dwelt with riches. This third woe, we could say, deals with power. The riches of this world won't last, and neither will power in this world. It will be replaced by the power that God has over all nations. We have riches, we have power. Let's go to the fourth woe, Habakkuk 2, verses 15 through 18. "Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbor, pressing him to your bottle, even to make him drunk, that you may look on his nakedness. You are filled with shame instead of glory. You also drink and be exposed as uncircumcised. The cup of the Lord's right hand will be turned against you, and utter shame will be on your glory. For the violence done to Lebanon will cover you, and the plunder of beasts which made them afraid because of men's blood, and the violence of the land and the city and of all who dwell in it." Of all who dwell therein. That brings us to verse 17. That's where we wanted to stop. So here, the reference is to drunkenness and sexual sins, with a note that such people are seeking glory. That is, the bringing low of others in order to stand over them. They're seeking not the glory of God, but their own glory. We could even say it's like fame. And riches, power, and fame, that's basically the things that people do seek after quite often. they're looking upon, again, their own needs rather than those of others. They depend on themselves. They put their faith in their own things instead of looking to God. And the reward for such behavior, God says, is, instead of fame, shame. The shame that such people bring to others shall be brought upon themselves. However, the first part of this verse suggests that the perpetrators are themselves drunk already. The word "also" is used before the statement that they make them drunk, or after it, actually, make them drunk also. Let's turn to Revelation 18 and verse 3. Revelation 18 and verse 3. What is it that God prophesied with regard to Babylon, the kingdom doing the conquering in Habakkuk? We've already been to Revelation once, but there's one another interesting parallel here to the Babylon described in Habakkuk. Revelation 18 and verse 3, we get this description. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So here we have a parallel description, and the central metaphor here is drunkenness and sexual sin. There is a perpetual party going on, one that concerns itself only with the self rather than with the good of others and with the glory of God. And that brings us to the fifth woe, which is described in Habakkuk 2, verses 18 through 20. We've seen a woe having to do with bloodshed, a woe having to do with covetousness for riches, a woe having to do with covetousness for power, and a woe having to do with covetousness for glory or fame. And now, like this first woe, the last woe turns again to a more general cask. Habakkuk 2, verses 18 through 20. What profit is the image that its maker shall carve it? The molded image, a teacher of lies, that the maker of its mold should trust in it to make mute idols. Woe to him who says to wood, awake, to silent stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, yet in it there is no breath at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Here, rather than writing of the penalty of a sin being heaped back on the perpetrator of it, the author, with his last woe, makes a contrast between idols, and we could say the last three woes have been idols of a sort, and God himself, between the impotence of idols and the power, indeed the very existence of God. Back in Habakkuk 1 and verse 11, the author here talked of the Chaldean Empire. And the prophecy was that the Chaldeans would impute this power of taking over Judah unto their own God. The Chaldeans seek after their own riches, their own power, their own glory, and they do this by bloodshed, by drunkenness, by illicit sex. And God here says that all of these sins shall be heaped back onto the Chaldeans and their gods, which are not gods at that time, shall not have the power to defend the Chaldeans. God alone is God. What do we put our faith in? Do we put it in dumb idols? Do we put it in ourselves, in our riches, our power, our fame? None of these can stand before God. None of these are worthy of our enduring faith. This is God's answer to Habakkuk. The Chaldeans will be punished just as Judah, which has done the same, shall shortly be. In this sense, then, God's answer to Habakkuk's concerns about the seeming injustice of using an evil nation to punish another nation, in Habakkuk's eyes, a less evil nation, is complete. That answer is given to us in the form of a set of woes, a discussion of the various punishments the very punisher itself will receive. But that answer is also a warning to us about how self-righteousness can interfere with our faith in God. You see, for each woe is in fact an idol, something that we as humans are prone to put our faith in. We take action by violence, defend ourselves by violence. We seek after money, we seek after power, we seek after fame. We think that any one of these things will protect us, and we justify our actions by comparing ourselves to others, as Judah itself here was doing, in claiming itself to be less evil than the Chaldeans and thus less deserving of punishment. The Jewish peoples were justifying themselves. But being less evil is immaterial. Our justification doesn't come from within. It doesn't come from ourselves. Our justification comes from Christ. And whether we commit three sins or 20 sins, we're still sinners and still in line for punishment. Our righteousness can only be established through God. And it is to God that we have to look to if we are to attain that righteousness. And it is in God that we must place our faith. In the next chapter, Habakkuk, having received an answer to his prayers from God, will see in a vision that answer fulfilled. And in that fulfillment, he'll learn yet more about the faith that we as Christians need to be inculcating in our daily lives. But all of that is for yet another message.